Hey guys, Ron Placone here. You are listening to the Indie Bohemians. First of all, some groundkeeping. Carmen will be back next week. And by the way, update, I am on the road. Depending on when you hear this, you might be able to catch me. I will be in Albuquerque, New Mexico on Friday, July 22nd. Some of you, if you get the podcast right away, you'll be getting this on Thursday, July 21st, which Thursday tonight, July 21st, I will be at the Santa Ana Star Casino in Santa Ana Pueblo, New Mexico, which is right outside of Albuquerque. So if you're in the Albuquerque area, I'll be around. So I'm coming at you from a hotel room. Here's the thing. My guest this week is Derek Sheen. Now, Derek and I go way back. See, here's the thing. When you start in comedy, you do what are called, you go to open mic nights, basically. And you go to as many of those a week as you can, sometimes almost every night. And you work on your stuff. And you meet a lot of other people that are in the same boat as you. They recently just started, too. And it kind of becomes your class, in a way. It becomes your peer group, and then you have some guys that are a little bit further up the ladder than you, and then some guys that are way far up the ladder, but you have access to and you learn from, and that's the comedy scene in any given place, you know, usually a city, but, you know, any given place. And, you know, I've said this a couple times, but I really, you know, the scene, the class, so to speak, that I came up with, I got pretty lucky because when I started in Seattle, a lot of the people that I started with are still doing really wonderful things. And statistically, the amount of people that are still in the game and doing great things is pretty inspiring, and I would say it's kind of exceptional. I mean, there are people writing for television now. Many have been on TV. Some have gone on to do other related things. One's a successful playwright. One's a personality in the city now with a pretty big local following and still going on the road some. A lot are on the road. A lot are doing colleges. A lot are just doing great things. And it's inspiring. And I already said some are writing for TV. I almost repeat it. I'm thinking of people in my head. But I remember the day that I got my first show booking in Seattle. Because, you know, you start doing mics, and then eventually someone asks you to be on a real show, a proper booked show. And for me, when this happened, man, it was amazing. It was a show called Lowball, which was it stood for Local Ballard Comedy Show. It took place in the Ballard neighborhood in Seattle, which was also a neighborhood where a little band called Nirvana played a lot when they got started. So I'm on cloud nine, man. When I got my first Lowball booking, man, did I feel special. I couldn't believe someone booked me for a comedy show, and not just for a comedy show in Ballard, Washington, where the Sunset Tavern is, where Nirvana used to play some of their early gigs. Man, was I stoked. And Derek Sheen, this week's guest, had something to do with that. He was one of the co-producers on that and did a lot with that show. He was one of the veterans in the scene when I was starting out. And I remember the next day, I was still on cloud nine the next day, right? I don't even remember if my set was good or not. I think I was just so excited it didn't even matter, but I guess I did fine. But the next day I saw Derek. At the time he was working at a music store right down the street from my apartment. I didn't know he was working there. I was just in there to get guitar strings because I was doing a little strumming. And there's Derek. And man, it was just, I really felt like I was part of something. You know, he knew my name. He was like, Ron Placone. I was like, man, that's a real comic, and he knows me. Man, this is something. And all these years later, Derek's still doing his thing. I'm still doing. Here's something interesting as a quick aside. I also still remember when I got my first road dates, right? I mean, a little while after my first booking on Lowball, I got my first set of road dates. And it was from a company called Triple Run. And if you're in comedy, you've heard of Triple Run. Basically, they're these one-night performances in bars and casinos, typically. And they're all throughout the Northwest. They're throughout Montana, Idaho, and then some in the Southwest. And it's a lot of driving. And they've been around for years. The Triple Run has been around for years and years and years. And there's actually a movie loosely based on it called Stages, the Montana Run, that I believe is loosely based on the Triple Run experience. And it's a rite of passage, even still to this day. It's a rite of passage in the stand-up comedy world. And I remember I got my first dates going through Montana and Idaho. And I was so excited. I printed out my itinerary. I saved it to my computer. I still have it saved on a hard drive somewhere just to have it. And it was, I think when all was said and done, I didn't make a dime because there was so much driving from Seattle to Montana to Idaho. I wasn't getting paid much. But I had the time of my life. And interestingly enough, I'm coming at you from New Mexico, and the gig that I'm doing tonight is a Triple Run gig. So I guess there's sort of some weird parallels going on here, and especially with my guest this week being Derek, made me think back to those days. Derek Sheen has had a crazy life. His father was involved in the mob and mafia-related activities. His stepfather was abusive. His mom at one point sent him to a Scientology boarding school and did not realize it was a Scientology boarding school. And we dive into it. IndieBohemians@gmail.com. You are listening to the Indie Bohemians.
It's time for the Monkey Minute. I'm Angie Doran for the Indie Bohemians. A male white-cheeked gibbon was born at Nashville Zoo on June 5th. The zoo is giving the public an opportunity to choose a name by making a conservation donation. Go to nashvillezoo.org and vote for one of the following names between now and July 31st. The three names are Mingli, which is Chinese for bright propriety, Makeo, which is Laotian for gift of God, and Makoto, which is Laotian for honesty. Each vote is a $1 donation to Fauna and Flora International, an organization that protects gibbon habitats in China and Vietnam. Nashville Zoo will match all donations made for the naming contest. The name with the most donations will be announced in August. That's the Monkey Minute. I'm Angie Doran for the Indie Bohemians.
Hey guys, Ron Placone here. A lot of prominent Republicans are skipping out on the convention this year because of Donald Trump. Here's some of them. Jeb Bush, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush. No one cares about Jeb. George H.W. is just too old. And as far as G.W. goes, it's not like it's a fun, joyous event where he can sing and dance, you know, like a funeral. Mitt Romney, who said that Donald Trump is a fraud and is as useless as a degree from Trump University. In fairness to Mitt, over 47% of the country thought that that was a good burn. John McCain, because Donald Trump insulted the fact that he was a prisoner of war. No joke there, let's just take a second and think about how awful it is that that actually happened. Sarah Palin, because Ohio's a long way from Alaska, it's not like it's right next door like Russia. John Kasich is a maybe for the same reason as Sarah Palin, it's a bit of a commute. Winky face. So a lot of the GOP is sitting this one out in the fair city of Cleveland, home of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In fairness though, that's a genre that hasn't really been kind to their party in recent years. This is Ron Placone, signing out.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Forkful of Noodles. I am Krish Mohan.
Ben Carson, the droopy dog of the Republican Party, rallied against the transgender community as part of the GOP's Festival of Hate. They call it the Republican National Convention, but we see through the facade, guys. Carson said that it's disturbing to him that the secular progressives are saying this is a matter of civil rights and what it might do to our children. Yes, we shouldn't be treating our children to try to understand those that are different than us and treat them like they're people. Compassion, what a terrifying concept for the youth to learn. Carson claims it's absurd to wake up one day and say you want to be a different gender. Yeah, because transgenderism is like wanting a bagel from Einstein, a decision that you make at 2 a.m. after you've been drinking too much. You know, there are several animals in the world that go between genders. Clownfish, parrotfish, hawkfish can literally change their genders. Seahorses are just confused about their genders. We should better spend a ton of time and money trying to eradicate the ocean of these absurd creatures that have transcended closed-minded societal viewpoints. Carson goes on to compare this to wanting to change races. Not the same thing. And cultural appropriation is already happening. The rapper Eminem is an example of that. And how many white kids do we know that are trying to act like black rappers? The way people are handling this issue is starting to get out of hand. In Wisconsin, there's a school that wants trans kids to wear green bracelets to ID them. Best case scenario, they want to know exactly who to ask questions about the trans issue. Worst case, Nazi Germany, the sequel. Carson needs to be educated on this issue, but unfortunately that's going to involve his party considering education as a value. That's been your Forkful of Noodles for this week. Thank you for tuning in, and we will see you next week.
Hey guys, Ron Placone here. Religious corruption, bickering, plagiarism, white supremacy, and some gratuitous nudity. Plot for the next Hollywood blockbuster with the social conscious? No, the GOP convention. A lot on the right like the sentiment, thoughts, and prayers, but sometimes thinking is optional with those prayers. Pastor Mark Burns gave a politically charged prayer where he referred to the group as the Conservative Party of God and said that they needed to defeat the Liberal Democratic Party. If God's anything like his supposed son, he's probably wondering what Liberal Democratic Party the pastor was referring to. Rick Perry gave a speech not even mentioning Donald Trump. Of course, Rick Perry's not a fan of Donald Trump and endorsed him very begrudgingly, so now he's just pretending that he doesn't exist. That's right, to Rick Perry, Donald Trump is his new Austin. Representative Steve King called other groups of people, quote, subspecies. Melania Trump stole part of her speech from Michelle Obama. And I bet you're wondering about the gratuitous nudity part. Over 100 women stood naked in protest. The protest was organized by male photographer Horny McHornerson. So far, the most mild event was Stephen Colbert dressing like that dude from The Hunger Games and sabotaging the podium. Because sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. This is Ron Placone, signing out. Ron Placone here. You are listening to the Indie Bohemians. My guest today, an old friend of mine, hilarious comedian. So glad we got to cross paths again, man.
I love this. This is great.
Derek Sheen.
Hello. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Thanks for stopping by. Right. Wonderful to see you again. It's been years, man. I think it's been since like 2011.
It has been. It's been a real long time. Yeah, you moved and I've been on the road and it's been kind of nuts. I'm glad we had a chance to catch up here and...
Yeah.
Ron made me lunch, which was delicious.
I did. Yeah. It was okay. You're not
just
saying that.
It was great. No, I'm not just saying that.
I made pasta.
It was very spicy, which I like. That's how I like it.
Well, no, I know that's how you like it. Because I remember in Derek is, me and Derek were buddies in Seattle when I was first starting comedy. Derek was one of the veterans on the scene, and we became friends. I remember I made pasta once. And you like the spicy level of it, so I made sure I was generous with the red pepper flakes.
Thank you.
I remembered.
It's the best way to have it. It's how you're supposed to eat it, you know? It's more like a puttanesca.
Yeah. So you've got a lot of projects in the works right now. You've put out a couple albums. You've been touring relentlessly. Let's talk about the book that you got coming up. We were talking about that a good bit off mic.
I've been working on this book. I think it's going to be a 3 or 4 year project overall. I'm pounding through the outlines right now and doing a few sample chapters and really trying to tie things together. But I'm also doing a lot of research on my dad. The book is really not just about my dad, but I want to make sure that I get that part right, and it's going to be incredibly time-consuming because my dad, who I didn't meet until I was 16, because he spent all of the rest of my childhood going from prison to prison. Mm-hmm. He worked for the mob. He worked for the Gambino family. He worked for the Calicuccios in Seattle, which was an arm of the Gambino family. He turned state's evidence in the 70s. He left town to... and became a government informant and a DEA informant. He was a contract killer. He trafficked in humans and in coke and heroin and all. I think almost up until the time he died, he was working with the, at least probably with the DEA at some point. So,
where was he at on the timeline when you met him for the first time?
When I met him, he had just gotten out of Lompoc. Federal penitentiary.
Okay.
For, at that point, he had just been busted. In 77, he was in San Francisco. He got arrested for murder. The guy's name was John Wyckoff, I think. It was a mob attorney who had been laundering money, and it was a contract killing. And then he got acquitted, which I'm suspecting now through some research because he was a government informant. So he was sort of pushed into a situation, and I think they basically acquitted him because he was still working for the government and turning evidence over.
So even when he committed this crime, he was an informant at that point?
Yeah.
It wasn't like he did that and they were like, hey, you got to help us out now unless you want to spend...
No, I think he was already a government informant.
Okay.
Because he literally shot the guy in his house in front of his kids. So, I mean, they know he did it.
Mm-hmm.
But the circumstances are, as I'm starting to put the pieces together, it's because I think he was an informant, and the government was like, we can't prosecute him because he has all this information on these three different mob families and all the heroin that's coming into the country. So we kind of just have to let him lead this double life.
Wow.
So
what was that first meeting like?
Well, I met him in 80... I met him in 85 on my 16th birthday. He had just gotten out of Lompoc for... he'd been held on... he was charged with treason. And the newspaper articles I found, he'd set up a meeting with the Syrians. He'd been working on this for like a year. He promised them that he could sell them an atomic weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And also a whole bunch of blueprints that they had for stolen government projects, which none of the projects were real. They hired a drafter. The drafter put together all these amazing pieces of equipment on stolen Boeing blueprint paper from their aerospace division,
mm-hmm.
which were all serial numbered and hand numbered. So they thought they were buying military secrets. The Syrians that he'd been working with were FBI agents. So he ended up going to Lompoc because they couldn't acquit him on that. The federal judge was like, you said you would sell them an atomic weapon. Like, you had access to things you shouldn't have had access to.
So how did he have access to that?
He didn't have access to an atomic weapon.
Okay.
But stealing blueprints from the aerospace division is a treasonable offense.
Mm.
Because they're private, and it's also owned by the government. And it's like stealing military secrets. The only difference is none of the weapon systems they developed were real. So he spent 7 years in Lompoc in the desert, and then his sentence was commuted, and he came back to Seattle, and that was when I met him. I was 16, and I spent my birthday with him, and we went all over the state delivering cocaine.
Really?
Yeah, we
were. Did he tell you that's what you were doing?
Not until the end of the day. We went out. He picked me up. He picked me up from an AA meeting that I was going to. I was 16 and going to the program. I had a friend that was in the program, so I was like, I'll go and do it. And so...
Were you having problems?
No.
No,
it's just like, you know, when you shave your head, when your friend gets cancer, it's the same kind of thing.
Oh, okay. All right.
So he picked me up, and we went out, and I was like, are we going to go see Spies Like Us? I think that's what I want to do for my birthday. And he's like, hey, we'll spend some time driving around, run some errands, we'll get to know each other, we'll go... So we were supposed to go to the movies. That's what I wanted to do. And, we ended up in Aberdeen, Washington, because he was like, we got to run some errands first, and as soon as we do that, we'll go see Spies Like Us, which is what I wanted to go see. And we ended up in Aberdeen at this beautiful house, this huge place, and I waited in the living room. My dad said he needed to talk to his friend, and we got there. The guy was super nervous, and long story short, essentially what my dad was doing was picking up two whole keys of cocaine that he was supposed to move for this guy who he had gotten in trouble with before he went to jail. So his penance was to be the middle guy for a little while, the mule, and move a whole bunch of coke for him.
Wow.
But in the meantime, he'd also, and I didn't know this till later on, but he'd also jammed his gun in my dad's mouth and threatened to blow his brains out in his office while I was waiting in the living room. I learned about this all after we got done with an entire day of delivering drugs, which I got paid for. I didn't know exactly what we did.
And paid for
he gave me $1,000 for my 16th birthday at the end of the day. And then when I asked him what we did, he was like, "Are you sure you want to know? Like, do you want to know what we did? Because if you know, then you're complicit. You're an accomplice." And I was like,
"You were 16.
Yeah. And I was like, "I want to know." So when he told me, I was pretty freaked out. And I was kind of panicked, but at the same time, like, he poured me a glass of scotch, which completely, you know, I was off the wagon at that point. But then he told me everything. He told me about work, like, the guy that he murdered in San Francisco. He told me about all the other jobs he started. Then he got more drunk as the night progressed and told me everything. It was pretty crazy. And
did you feel? Like, what was going through your head?
I was freaked out and shocked, but at the same time, I was a little excited by it because I was like, this is my dad. Like, but I also spent most of my life not wanting to be like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I knew he was a bad guy, but I just, you know, I'd spent most of my life being a goody two-shoes. And so it was interesting. And, you know, I was also a kid who didn't really have a father figure, so I kept thinking, like, I can make this work. I can work with this. I can change him, you know? Maybe mm-hmm. I'll be able to, the guy to change him, but that never happened. I mean, I was the black sheep in that part of the relationship because I never seen the inside of a jail. I've never committed a crime. I've always been a good kid. I was always real honest. I didn't do drugs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've done drugs, but I didn't do drugs, you know.
You weren't, yeah.
But, you know, my dad was the opposite of that. He was the life of the party. He was a super charming guy, but he was also a really bad dude who had, you know, I think his core was a little off. I mean, I feel like he got my, you know, he did get my sisters hooked on drugs. But I think he didn't do it because he wanted them hooked on drugs. He did it because it made them easier salespeople. Like, if they were hooked on drugs, and so their friends were hooked on drugs. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he was a real monster.
Did he ever try to get you involved? I mean, other than the 16 thing?
He tried, but I would always turn stuff down because he knew. He knew that I'm the kind of guy that would have turned him in. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm the kind of kid that if I did that again, I would have turned him in. You know?
Wow.
It's just, it was in my makeup. I would have said something. And so, and he knew that, so he kept me at an arm's length. Which is great for me, because I have still never seen the inside of a jail or been in a hospital for overdosing. But he was a weird guy. I mean, he died, you know, 10 years ago, like this month.
Oh, wow.
But I also don't believe that it was a happy accident.
Well, what happened?
He went in for an angioplasty. And I got to be honest, he really, I mean, he had a lot of enemies. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's still, you know, one thing I'm careful about writing this book is that I'm trying to make sure that a lot of people that he dealt with are dead or in jail, because they're still, you know, who knows who's still mad at my dad years down the road, or who, you know, who wants a little bit of extra closure. I mean, he had a lot of enemies. My sister and I aren't totally convinced that it was an accident. I'm very positive that there was something hanky that happened behind the scenes. He went in for an angioplasty, and they were wheeling him to ICU, and his nurse took a detour and dumped his wheelchair down a flight of stairs in the construction area, which made him a complete quadriplegic. He didn't die, but he almost died. And then the night that they brought him back to ICU, you know, with his head brace on and everything, right? And, like, he had one of those weird crowns where they lock everything in.
Yeah.
Because his head was split open.
Well, what happened to the nurse? Did she...
So she took off.
She took off.
She took off.
Just, like, right after she dumped him,
according to the attorneys, and I don't think I signed a privacy agreement, but according to the attorneys, she had left town. She was impossible to contact. Her name had been changed. And she had a considerable nest egg when she left. So she was completely incommunicado. The university couldn't reach her for questioning. So then that night, they put him in his bed in ICU. And, you know, of course, again, he has a huge crown on, and they have those screws in his shoulders and everything because his head was split. and his neck was broken, so it was to re-straighten his spine to keep him from, you know, making it worse. And they didn't put his bed frames up in his bed. He's quadriplegic. So he just rolled out of bed in the middle of the night and reopened everything, like cracked his head open, broke the what do they call the angel halo, the halo,
mm-hmm.
broke that, and then went into a coma. And then,
wow.
Then, you ready for this? At the week two of his coma, the hospital realized that he was a liability because they had been responsible now twice in less than a month for making him a comatose patient. They sent him to a nursing home, and they didn't tell anybody in the family where it was at. They sent him to this weird nursing home, which, by the way, was one of the, I think, graded like the second worst nursing home in the country. So by the time we found him, when we found him, my grandmother found him along with a private investigator, and they had put a padlock outside of his door. So they hadn't changed his diaper or anything in like 3 weeks. He'd been sitting in this bed as a complete comatose quadriplegic. And when they found him, he had now had a staph infection in his bone marrow because the diaper had just rotted through.
Oh,
and
man.
And ate him alive.
How is he still alive?
Oh, I don't know. But, the staph infection is what essentially killed him in the end.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so you guys are looking for him throughout this mm-hmm. whole thing, trying to find out what went on. What did the hospital tell you when you went there?
It was all subterfuge. And their attorneys were like, we don't remember. We'll try to figure it all out. I mean, you know, the hospital administrators thought they sent him to this place, but it might have been different. But your insurance says that we sent him here. And they just wanted to play the game. They wanted to keep him out of the hospital for as long as possible.
So chances are, like there were people in on this.
Oh, yeah, there definitely was. I mean, we the lawsuit that they settled out was substantial. And it went mostly to my nephew, who my dad had adopted and raised as his own. So to make sure that he was taken care of, he had, you know, some developmental stuff. And he's a great kid, but, you know, we figured he could probably use the money because he didn't have a care system in place. So, but, yeah, they lost it. Yeah, we won, and it was a considerable amount of money that he took out of the hospital and also out of the nursing home, but the nursing home was completely gone. They were so mired in lawsuits that
they were just done.
Their insurance was like, here's a check for $10,000 and we're done. We have nothing left.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is, and so that was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're trying to piece together the fine details of his life.
Right, so I'm like, you know, while I'm in L.A., I'm going to go to San Mateo and go through his criminal records and trial records and try to get all the transcripts of stuff. I mean, he was in and out of jail all the time. I mean, I've got stacks of stuff just from Seattle and Washington State, you know, petty crimes, theft, assault, you know, in and out of prison all the time.
How do you think he got involved initially? Like, do you know any, like...
He was a young kid. He was he went to Catholic school in Seattle and got hooked up with a lot of, Seattle had a pretty healthy Italian population.
Okay.
Diehard Italian. The Catholic school he went to is the same place that Frank Calicuccio's kid went to. He got hooked up with some kids whose dads, you know, were a little nefarious.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of ran the game at O'Day High School. And when he got out, he got a job at a used car business, which was a front for selling coke and heroin. And then he got his foot in the door with the mob, even though he was Irish. But he was, he's a drug mule and into trafficking and a muscle and a bad guy. And that was his job.
Wow.
And then he got busted in 71 and got caught. I mean, he was basically arrested for trafficking. And he turned state's evidence on the mob while in prison. My mom left him immediately because she was like, she had no idea what was going on. And we got followed all over the place for probably 3 or 4 months because they didn't know if my mom knew anything.
Do you remember any of this?
I don't remember any of this. Okay, I was a year and a half old, yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, my dad finally turned state's evidence in 71. They sent him to another prison outside of Seattle. And then when he got out, he became a DEA informant for a short period of time and then a government informant.
So let's try to...
And I found that out because a lot of the court records that I found with his name in them, he wasn't in court. It was they were the federal prosecutors were using his name because he was the federal witness who mm-hmm. had turned over evidence on whoever they were trying to get a conviction on. On more than one occasion, they were like, "Well, Michael Sheen is our informant. He works for the government, Your Honor." And then that was always the part that I would see in these transcripts.
Michael Sheen. Well, have you like tried? I mean, I guess this is sort of like the top of the thing, and you've probably been in contact, but like something like the Mob Museum.
But
organizations like that.
He wouldn't be. I mean, they wouldn't have his name on a record.
Okay.
Because he wasn't involved in the way that he was family or he was part of the organization. He was an outlier.
Okay.
You know, he was a guy that would show up when somebody when they owed money. He's the guy that would show up and break fingers. He's the guy that would show up and, you know, put a gun to somebody's head and say, "You owe this guy money."
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was the guy that, I'm pretty convinced did off a few people. And it was just, you know, the thing is, it was bad people killing bad people. Like, none of those guys ever killed innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
They just killed each other. So it was very, they were very exclusive, you know, in the sense that, and incestual, when they murdered each other, it was just guys that were already in the business.
So what was the relationship going forward from 16? You find out everything about...
We had a real on and off relationship. We fought a lot. I didn't agree with his lifestyle, although, you know, I liked trying to help him out. And I really tried to have a relationship with him, but it was impossible because it just wasn't in the cards. But we did spend time together. We just spent a lot of time together arguing.
What were the arguments like?
Oh, man, just about everything. Sometimes he'd argue, but he wanted to argue about history. He wasn't that smart, but he wanted to argue about history or literature, or he'd want to argue about politics, or he'd want to argue about his lifestyle and...
What were his views? Was he a liberal guy, conservative?
He was kind of in the middle. He was a fiscal conservative, but had liberal leanings.
Okay.
Because he was in the crime world, so of course he's going to be a fiscal conservative.
Right.
Right. But he was super liberal about everything else. He was a drug addict. Mm-hmm. How many conservative cokeheads do you know?
Well, I mean, Wall Street's probably got a few. I'd imagine. Not to generalize.
Yeah. But. You know, I mean, he had liberal leanings, I think. I don't know if he ever paid his taxes. I'm pretty sure he didn't.
Probably a farce return, right?
A lot of shit was under the radar.
I've seen The Sopranos.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of stuff was under the radar, and I don't think that he, I don't think he was above board in a lot of stuff. But at the same time, I mean, we always had dumb arguments because I think that was just the way that we communicated. Because I didn't agree. As I got older, I did not agree with his lifestyle and the stuff that he did. I couldn't let it rest. You know, it really mm-hmm. bothered me a lot.
Yeah.
And it was like that all the way up until he died. You know, when the last time we met, we went out to lunch at some restaurant. He was real gaunt and thin. You know, he's having heart issues and was trying to convince me that he'd turned his life around. And you hear that stuff all the time, you know, from people that have done real bad things. I found God. Turning my life around, and I'm trying to be a better Christian. And I was like, "Why are you? It doesn't matter. You don't need to tell me that."
Yeah.
So it always seemed like there was a little bit of window dressing.
And so he went that route. He found God at one point.
Yeah. And you know, everybody in my family's like, "He's reborn, and he's just trying to get better." And I'm like, "No, he's dying. That's what people do when they're dying, is they tell you that I'm absolved, right? I didn't. Everything's better." So I just never bought into it. I always felt like it was a Hail Mary pass at the end to try and, you know, get some absolvement, and you murdered people. You can't get away. Like, you don't get to do that at the end. I never felt comfortable with that.
Did you tell him that?
No, because I felt like I didn't want to fight anymore. Mm-hmm. And he was so close to, you know, he was not in great shape. I mean, he wouldn't have lived past the next 2 years anyways. And I was just getting married at the time, and I went, you know what? I got to a place in my... In my, you know, my early 30s where I was just done fighting. I had this great relationship. I had a better relationship with my mom and the other side of my family, and things were coming together. And I had this new family, you know, my wife's mom and dad and her brother and sister, like, became an actual family to me. And I was like, I don't want to fight on this anymore. Like, I'm done. You tell me what you need to tell me, and then we'll, you know, we'll work on it later. And then 3 days later, he was in a coma, and Al and I, my wife and I, went and visited him, and I was like, well, I guess that's that, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, but when he died, it still messed me up, because I always wished that there would have been something there. But you can't, you just can't create it out of nothing.
Do you ever feel guilty?
Mm-mm, not at all.
That's good. I mean, you shouldn't.
No.
But I would
I never wonder... beat myself up about that. I feel mm-hmm. bad for him. I feel bad that he didn't really have the relationship with his kids that he could have had. And I don't think he wanted it, though. He was a very selfish dude. You know, that was his, I mean, it, you know, according to his lifestyle, that's the lifestyle of someone who doesn't want to, you know, kowtow to anybody else's needs or be available.
Well, how are your sisters now? Are they still on drugs, or are they?
No, my older sister lives in Kentucky with a really great dude. She got married a while ago, and she's now got her son back, which is my nephew that my dad had adopted. And she's got a family. You know, she works real hard. She's clean and happy and trying to build a life. Although her health is shot, I think, as a result. But my younger sister, I don't know what she does. I don't really stay in touch with her much anymore.
Okay.
After my dad passed away, I felt like I didn't need that relationship anymore, so I kind of cut ties.
Okay.
So, I love my uncle and my aunt, you know, his brother and his sister-in-law are great, and they're so different, but I just, once he was gone, I felt like that was the parachute I needed to kind of be away from that side of the family.
Well, when you say, like, you knew he was a bad guy, I mean, how much did you know from birth until 16?
I had a lot that my mom told me and that his friends told me. And, you know, my family, his mom and dad never told me anything. They were very much in denial about his lifestyle because I think they felt, being that they were good Catholics and part of the community, that it reflected badly on them.
Okay.
And so they did that Catholic guilt thing where they were like, he's never done it. People say he's done bad things, but he hasn't really done bad things. They're just trying to make him look bad.
Wow.
But yeah, there were a lot of protection going on. But, you know, you would talk to his friends and they're like, no, things are real bad. Like, your grandparents, grandparents' house got shot up.
Wow, happened?
Oh, yeah. There was a car full of dudes that came by. They thought my dad was still living there and shot all the windows out.
Were your grandparents at the time?
They were in the house.
So they just ducked?
On the floor. They ducked, and then they immediately, the best part is, they were so in denial that they didn't call the police. The neighbors did. They didn't call the police. And then they were like, it was just some kids playing a prank. And they immediately...
A prank?
They got the glass replaced. That day they called somebody on a rush and got the glass replaced, cleaned everything up. The next day the neighbors were like, they were outside puttying all the holes and repainting because they just didn't want anybody to know. They wanted to get it cleaned up and out of the way as quickly as possible.
I mean, they didn't think to just move, like...
It's their house. Also, they weren't doing well enough to move.
Wow.
My grandfather had a small barbershop business, and my grandmother was an accountant for Boeing. And they'd just, you know, they'd rebought the house in like 78 or something, so I don't think they were about to leave. I mean, that was the house they died in, you know.
So it never happened again. It was a one-time thing.
It's a one-time thing, but there were other people that would come over to the house and
just see
for my dad. And yeah, there was a lot of weirdos that came by.
Well, how did they explain that? Like, people were
they never did. They never explained it.
They would
just ignore it and keep it to themselves. And if people asked, they would go, "You're crazy. That never happened. That was just a guy who came over to deliver the mail, or someone was just had the wrong address." Yeah.
So then what, I mean, let's get into your childhood then. I mean, what was it like just sort of being in this climate? Like, it seems
lucky
like...
Lucky enough, I wasn't. Lucky enough, okay. I had my mom and my stepdad, and I was removed for most of it. I mean, I'd go see my grandparents, and occasionally when my dad was in town, they tried to sneak him over, but I don't remember seeing him because it was illegal. I mean, you know, my mom had a restraining order against him for me. He wasn't allowed to see me. Until I was of legal age.
So what was that? I mean, let's get back to that first encounter then. Like, what did your mom tell you? She's like, I've kept this guy away from you. He's not a good dude.
She never said bad things until I was in my early teens and really started to dig. And that's when she, you know, pulled out the newspaper clippings, the envelopes full of, you know, court stuff, and sat me down and was like, this is what your dad does. This is who he was. And she would start explaining what she knew up until like 72 or 73 when she stayed in touch. But, you know, she knew he was bad news. My uncle was still affiliated with him once in a while and saw him a lot more than anybody else did and told me you know, that he was just he was a bad guy. That's what he did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he was in jail all the time.
Well, but your mom was aware you were going to see him. Like, your mom was aware.
Not
this
at first.
Is the meeting.
Not
no.
at first. Okay. She didn't know. I didn't tell her on my birthday. I didn't tell her. I canceled my birthday plans because I was like, I'm going to hang out with my dad and meet my dad.
So how did this unfold then? Like, unpack this. Like, did he contact you? Did you contact him?
Well, I saw him through my grandparents, and she, you know, they were like, hey, your dad's out of jail and he really wants to see you. And I talked to my dad on the phone. And we set up a meeting, and I was like, hey, it's my birthday. He's like, I'd love to do something for your 16th birthday, you know, and take you out, and let's spend the day together and catch up and be father and son. And I was like, yeah. And then we went and delivered Coke all day. Because he needed somebody to sit in the car and make sure that, you know, there was a getaway.
Wow.
So that was my job. That's how that was the first day we met. And I'll be honest with you, the rest of our relationship was precarious like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't sell drugs together after that, but I mean... You know, I was there just in case something happened. You know, that was, he leaned
on
me.
In what way? Like, what do you mean by that?
He wanted me to help watch the kid. He needed help driving from one place to the other, or I got a doctor's appointment, or can he come over and watch the apartment while I'm gone? But it wasn't a relationship. It was like, I need you. I need you to fill in a space for me or help me out.
How did you feel about that? Were you okay with it? Or
no, but I was at the same time, I'm like, whatever, I'll just do it.
It's your dad.
Yeah.
So then, like, what was your childhood like separate from that? Was it pretty, you were able to just separate it all?
The other side of it was even, I mean, just as equally terrible, but on a different, whole different level. Like, my stepfather was an abusive drunk, and my mom, who was wonderful, but, you know, we both lived in constant mortal fear. And then on the other side of the family, you know, I had a criminal mastermind who just kept going to jail every 3 minutes. So it was weird. I mean, if I had a choice, I would have rather not changed anything. I would still go live in that other situation again, just because I think it tempered me a lot more. It taught me about how to deal with abuse, and that, you know, anything else that life throws at you, you can easily weather it as long as you realize it's not you doing it, you know?
Okay.
And it did make me a stronger person, because I know I have, you know, I have a pretty strong set of personal values that, you know, that dad instilled in me. I never looked at, you know, my stepfather was a monster, but I never ever thought like that he had any power over me.
Okay.
Because he was just, that's who he was. He was a terrible person. It didn't make me a terrible person.
Well, how did he end up? What's the deal with him now?
Oh, he's dead too.
Okay. Yeah,
quadruple heart attack.
Did your mom kick him to the curb eventually?
We had a huge blowout in 80, I think 84 was when they split for the final time on Valentine's Day. And it was a huge, huge, I mean, there was always violence in the house, but it was a bad night. Like, everything melted down to the point where the cops got called. My dad waited across the street in a parked car loading his gun, and the cops found him and pulled him out and, you know, sent him to jail for a few nights. And then my mom got a restraining order, and we, you know, took months of going to court, and we lost everything. Like, he came to the house when she was at work and I was at school and cleaned out the entire house with a moving truck.
He just took everything?
Everything. Every stitch of clothes, every photo album, everything.
So all your stuff?
All, we lost
everything. How old were you?
14, 15, 14.
So you just come home from school and all your stuff is gone?
Literally, it was like the house was, like, we just moved into the house for the first time.
Did you get it back?
No.
Oh, man.
We lost everything.
Did they try to find the guy?
Well, I knew my stepdad. I mean, it was his stuff, right? I mean, they were going through a divorce, and it's Washington State, so, you know, it's not community property. It was like, it's my stuff. I bought it with my paycheck, so I'm taking it.
So, like, all, but I mean, like, your clothes and your,
yeah.
I mean, I know you're into music, your guitar, I take it.
Like, well, I was 14 at the time. I didn't have any.
Oh, you didn't have any of that?
Comic books and stuff and toys, but, you know, I didn't want any of it back. I figured, like, if we could just get out of that relationship clean, then we could just start over from scratch. I mean, that's the way I looked at it as a kid. I didn't get upset that we lost anything. You know, I remember sitting my mom down, and she was freaked out just because it was such a shock. But the next day, we were like, all right, well, you know what we'll do? We'll just start over. I mean, this is great for both of us. Wow. Now we don't have anything there that reminds him of us. And also, he has no reason to ever have to get in touch with us again, since he has everything.
That is, screw man, that is a crash screen. Course in growing up, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, wow.
Yeah.
I don't think that, I mean, at 14, but, that's a load.
But it was a good, you know, it was a whole lot of good tools to put in my toolbox.
Sure.
To be a, you know, to learn how to deal with stress and anxiety and abuse and, I was glad that I had it. I mean, I really was. I think a lot of people get to the middle of their life, and when things start to go haywire, they don't know how to deal with it, and they're not equipped to handle it. So I'm like, I already have a leg up. Like, I've lost everything more than once. I can live through that. It's nothing, you know?
So, were you just going to public school? Yeah. Like, was that just a fairly typical thing in your life?
Public school up until, I mean, I went to public school, elementary school. Long story short, this is going to be forever. From first grade up to sixth grade, I had cheated on all of my report cards because I did not like doing it. I didn't like going to school. I didn't like doing homework.
So what, you would like change the grades? Or?
Yeah, well, I found out that they were doing everything with carbon paper. Mm-hmm. And I found out that when you find the carbon paper in the garbage can and you collect it, then you have all the carbon paper and you can just change your grade with the back of a pencil or a fingernail. Because, you know, they didn't write anything, and they didn't handwrite them. They wrote everything in carbon, so you would have to get a carbon copy of your report card. Mm-hmm. But when you found the carbon paper, you could make it look legit. So I would just go out back every time my report cards came, steam open the envelope, sit down with the carbon paper, and change the E's to B's, and change the D's to B's, and, you know.
As a first grader?
Oh, yeah.
Man.
And then I got better at it as time progressed, and then by sixth grade, I got kind of cocky, and I got caught, and they told my folks, and my mom was like, how long has this been going on? And they sent me down to the school to get all of my transcripts from first grade to sixth grade, and my mom was like, you've got to be, like, you literally changed every single grade. Like, how did you even get through elementary school? But I just wasn't interested. I was doing my own thing, you know? I was writing and drawing. I was reading at a college grade level. I just didn't feel like school was my gig. I just had to do it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then as a result, they thought that, you know, he's got to have a learning problem. We should send him to private school. And then they sent me to the Delphian School in Sheridan, Oregon, which was what they found.
Okay.
And the Delphian.
Who's they? Who sent you?
My mom and dad.
Okay.
They looked for a private school, and they wanted to get me away from my friends and get me away from, like, remove me from the situation and send me someplace where, you know, I was isolated, and they found the Delphian School in Sheridan, which was a school built in an old monastery on the top of this mountain in Sheridan, Oregon, which was owned and operated by L. Ron Hubbard.
Oh, no.
And it was the branch of the learning school that he started, where he wrote the curriculum, controlled the environment. Everyone there was a Scientology counselor, and it was a school for Scientology kids. So I became a fake Scientologist for 2.5 years while I lived in this monastery.
You lived among Scientologists?
Yeah, I had to. There was nowhere to go.
Did your parents know that was what it was?
Nope, my mom just was like, he's a science fiction author and you like science fiction, so I'll send you to this school.
So she didn't know what it was?
Mm-mm, she had no idea.
Wow. Nobody did. All right, so what was that like? I mean, that's...
It was goofy. I mean, you know, I just jumped in and did it because I was like, after a couple months, I'm like, well, I'm not going to do this because I already smell a rat. But, you know, I'll play along.
How old were you again?
12 or 13, I think. 13.
So
I was 12. That's right.
Did you know that, like, you took the E-meter thing and you heard about your Thetans?
Well, I didn't know, but they didn't give you the Thetan thing right off the bat. Like, that came later.
Okay.
They really just were into self-help, and they were like, you know, you just do your energy. It tells us that there are things you're trying to cover up. And I did the first auditing course, which cost some money, but my mom and dad didn't know what that was. And they were like, it's a course, so we'll just pay for the course. It's going to help you. Communications is, I think, how they build it. It was a communications course. And I was like, this is BS. But I'm going to go ahead and just do it. And then by the time I left, I'd been cleared. I'd already been through the first, been cleared level one.
Okay.
So I went through the first clearance level. I did the auditing course and I played along and I'm like, okay, I guess I'm a Scientologist for fun.
So how did you see through it off the bat? I mean, you were somewhat impressionable, right? You were 12.
No. I mean, I'd been through Catholic school, Presbyterian school. I went to a Baptist day camp where I faked speaking in tongues because I just wanted to have friends that all went to the same school or the same church. So I was a little smarter about that stuff. And
you have the skeptical mind.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always have. And when I got there, I realized, like, all the people that I talked to didn't seem like they were grounded, and it just didn't seem it didn't seem right. I mean, they were constantly, like, talking about, you know, my feelings and my, how my feelings and my intellect and ethics all sort of are, you know, part of the same package. And I was like, that all just seems like self-help BS. Like, I mean, it was a huge thing in the 70s and 80s, so I kind of already, you know, I'd been exposed to it with watching my parents do that stuff. Changing their diets, changing their religion, trying to find spirituality.
Wow.
So, you know, it just seemed like it was off. And in the longer I was there, the more it smelled real bad.
Did they ever label you an SP? Like, or, did you ever
speak out against it? No, no, no. I was never a suppressive person because I played along.
You played along?
Oh, yeah. I played along, and I followed the ethics guidelines as much as I could. I mean, I got busted for some things, and I changed my life. I'm doing that in air quotes, by the way. And, you know, just became adoptive of the principles. And then when my parents started going through their early breakup, before things went haywire, that's when the money dried up and I finally got to go home and I was like, I never want to do this again. Like,
did you tell your mom? Were you like, do you know where you sent me?
Nope. Wasn't worth it. I mean, she was going through a horrific divorce at the time and all the stress of like being in a relationship that was falling apart. I was like, I'm not going to add to that.
Wow.
I'll just keep it to myself.
Does she know now?
Well, she knows what Scientology is now. I mean, she understands that.
Well, did you tell her? Were you like, by the way, I know you didn't do this on purpose, but...
Well, I mean, it wasn't a bad thing. I mean, I got to go to Scientology school, so I got a great story out of it. You know,
yeah.
There was nothing negative came out of it except that I had to, like, keep my mouth shut and wander around the halls of a monastery with a bunch of old, like, you know, people who were broken. Just broken. That was their only job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the one thing I realized is all the adults that worked there, they were volunteering their time for the church. So they were all just broken, sad people that were trying desperately to get a leg up on, you know, come up a level. Maybe I can get into Sea Org. But they were never going to make it because they didn't have the money. They were drained hippies. And, you know, Scientology just, the foundation of their religion is built on the bones of those people.
So was there anyone else? Did you have any allies? Like, did you have any other people that were like, yeah, this is not for us?
I didn't. In fact, a lot of the kids that were there had been raised in it, so okay. They were already immune to that thinking. And so they were very defensive.
So you protective. Were by yourself?
Mm-hmm.
How did you get through? I mean...
I played along. It was fun.
Wow.
You know, I also had, you know, I had things I could do. I fell into books, and I read, and I, you know, I made friendships, but we just didn't talk about that other stuff. And they were, you know, they were all kids my age, so they weren't all super religious. I mean, it's, you know, it's a weird belief system, so they didn't talk about it very often.
Right.
But I never questioned it just because I, you know, you can tell that they were raised in it. They didn't know any better.
Are you still in touch with any of those?
No.
No.
No. Now I am labeled a suppressive person.
Oh, really?
Because in my early 20s. Oh, yeah. In my early 20s, I made quite a stink.
What happened?
I would start going to Scientology bookstores, and I'd... You know, I would start asking questions I didn't like, or I would, then when I got online eventually, I would get into every chat group and just be a butt about stuff. Because I, you know, I knew it was a huge lie. And I was, you know, I still had a little resentment over some of the ways that I feel like people got taken advantage of, so.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm on a list of people who can't, like, you know, and then whenever they have a public event...
Mm-hmm.
They have to keep a list of people that are not allowed to come into the building. And I
finally
made it onto
people.
That list, yeah.
Finally. Do you get mail every now and again?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
No, because I'm on that list of people they don't even want to communicate with.
Wow.
But they'll just, you know, if you show up at the Church of Scientology, they'll be like, can we talk to you for a second? You can't come in the building. So it's kind of like being blocked, but as a human being in a human place, it's real.
So basically you're like excommunicated.
Mm-hmm.
Like from the, wow.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, I've done podcasts and I've talked about it, you know, in other public mediums, you know, that like I'm sure that and also my online presence definitely did not help, you know, to keep me in good graces with them, which is fine because it's a terrible cult.
Have you talked about it in stand-up at all, that experience?
A little bit. I've talked about the stories, some of the stories from the Scientology school, but I haven't really talked about it as a whole just because I don't know how to make it funny because it's just sad, you know. It's like making fun of any other religion, except that it's not really a religion, it's just a cult, you know, and I feel like I'd be punching down in a way, just because, what do you do? I'd rather yell about it than make fun about it.
So...
I'd rather shake people out of it than...
Right.
Because otherwise I'm just preaching to the choir. It's a bunch of other people that are like, we get it. We don't like it either.
Right, right, right. So, going forward then, what else is on your trajectory? I mean, this book project, it seems like you're in the beginning stages.
I've been working on it for 3 years, and I think I have another 3 or 4 years before it's an actual physical thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's still a lot of research and a lot of massaging and really trying to figure out the narrative style, because it's very hard to I don't want to James Fry this thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to do a million little pieces and then get called out on the carpet because I got some things wrong or I embellished some things. Or
was there going to be an autobiographical nature? Like, you're going to talk about, this is what I do and this is how I got there and this was my dad? Or is it going to be,
this
was my
dad? I'm going to more share the stories and be very distanced from a lot of that.
Okay.
Because I don't want to make it about me as much as I want to just have the stories out there.
Okay.
I think they're more important than me, and so I want to have a vehicle to share that, but I'm still trying to figure out how to massage that into a thing that people would be interested in.
And then they're like, what did this guy end up doing? He's a comedian.
Yeah.
Nice. All right, so in the meantime, what's going on?
We're working on that. We're working on, we're in Hollywood, so we're working on a bunch of Hollywood stuff, like finishing a screenplay and starting another one and just trying to stay busy on that end. The third album is in the can and just got mastered, so that hopefully will keep me busy for a little while. Like, I'm out on the road all the time, and right now I want to get to the place where I don't have to be on the road all the time, because I just, I love being on tour, but I also hate not having something else to keep me busy.
You're really preaching to the choir now.
Yeah. So it's, but I wouldn't change a thing. I mean, I love what I do, and it's a weird job, but I also would like to get to that place where I'm allowed a lot more freedom to express myself without having to worry where the next meal is going to come from.
Where can people find out more about you?
FBI.gov. DerekTime.com.
DerekTime.com.
You can find me on Twitter at Derek Sheen. I'm pretty present on Twitter most of the time, except for right now. I'm staying off of it for a few days.
I think we need... We all kind of need a little bit.
Yeah,
of
I don't like to contribute.
As of the recording of this. This is going to come out a little later.
But there'll always be a time when Twitter's going to be terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the news. I'll be very honest with you. It's not the news that's keeping me off there. It is the constant trolling.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I can't play into that anymore. It really makes me so mad.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm having a real hard time with it. So but you can still get me on there, and I know I'll still be tweeting stuff. It's not always jokes right now. I'm literally just started tweeting at Donald Trump. I've been trolling that guy for months, and every day I send him probably 3 or 4 pictures of Cheetos I find online that look like genitals.
Nice. Nice.
And I'm trying so hard to get blocked. I really want to get blocked.
You'll get there. You'll get some kind of response. Well, Derek, thanks for doing this, man.
Thank you so much for having me, buddy, and thanks for a wonderful lunch and great conversation. This is awesome. I'm so glad we got to catch up.
DerekTime.com. I'm Ron Placone. You're listening to the Indie Bohemians.